Napa Invited Session 2017.
Friday morning, but we're excited to have this panel here, a really terrific panel that we've assembled here. In this session, just so you know, it's part of a larger, comprehensive, and integrated series of events at the AAA's this year. We also have this entitled Business Anthropology Matters. And we have this session, we have an executive session on Sunday, we have, 7-8 workshops.
Total about 13 workshops.
13 workshops, and we have a careers expo, so please stop by for the expo to share and inform theoretical, pedagogical, and practical discussions around business anthropology today. So we're really here to enlarge this discussion on business anthropology matters. It's really a new emerging field. It's very exciting. A lot of us are employed in either academia or in business somehow connected to business anthropology, and that will be our discussions today. Our goal is to inform audiences to the broad ways that business anthropologies and anthropologists are working in and out of academia, and to explore the ways of increasing the demand for business anthropology globally. So I'll introduce Bob Morais, is my colleague, partner on this. We put this together, and he has a couple of words to say too.
Did you introduce yourself as Tim now? These are going to be mercifully short presentations. These are flash presentations, meaning that they will last about 5 minutes each. And I think they're really more talks than presentations. I think so that everybody has PowerPoint, but we didn't require that. Everyone should feel encouraged and free to make comments after people have done their 5 minute spiel, basically. We want a lot of conversation. That's the idea. The conversation will be after each person, so we're basically allocating about 10 minutes per person. 5 minutes for them to speak, 5 minutes for some questions and discussion, and we're leaving time at the end for each person. But there are 9 people, so that 10 times 9 equals 90 minutes. We've got a little more than that, so we have a little bit of room. This is being recorded by Napa, who has kindly sponsored this. And I ask everybody to shut off their cell phones or put them on what I like to call stun, to make sure that you're not interrupted. And we're going to start with Patty Sunderman, and then we're going to move along as we go to the next
section. Sure. So just no need for introductions for Patty, but I have a short introduction. Patty Sunderland, she's going to talk on engaging the power of cultural comparison. So we look forward to her discussion. And yes, hold your questions till afterward, and then she'll respond to your questions. Here's Patty.
Well, it's nice to see there's a lot of old friends here in the audience, and that's nice to see because on the first day of Flash presentations, I had my goal yesterday to go see Flash presentations to see how they were done at AAA, but I never found them. So, So as I understood the task, it was also as a way of sparking a conversation with all of us. So it was just to take an idea, to just lay the idea out there, and then we would all discuss its value. So I took the power of cultural comparisons, and obviously, as you can see here, it's a traditional part of anthropology, of course. You know, there, like Abby's sitting with his axe while Suero is on, he's probably not doing it in that house to the right, which is a house in Chicago. Not really, by the way. But, you know, and Bambi Shefflin was my advisor, so I should know how this works. Okay, so what happened, the thing that happened here, the story that I want to tell, is there is a client in the Chicago area that, you know, we've worked with for so long, and so they had yet again another project about scent and personal space. And, you know, so they called and wanted us to examine what personal space means in the U.S., so I just thought, like, oh my God, this is so boring. So, you know, I'm working from home, really. And to be honest, and I don't work in a house like that, you know, I have a little apartment, but I'm on the phone, like, kind of pacing, just thinking, like, this is so boring. And to amuse myself, that was the only thing. To amuse myself, I said, This is recorded, I should remember that. myself, I started saying, like, you know what? You need to do this like other countries, you know. And first of all, it's about sensation, you know. Think France, think Proust. Like, you need to go to places that just thinks of, like, sensation very different. And then you need to go to a place where, like, things aren't branded, where every single thing is not coming in the branded good, because really, I just want to go to Ethiopia. So I'm like, I want to go to France, I want to go to Ethiopia. And I so, you know, I was kind of bullshitting, as they would say. And then as I'm pacing, I started to get into it and realized, this is a good idea. This is a really good idea. This is how they should do the study. And, you know, client got convinced too. Now, of course, the client says, but you need to do this, you know, I only have X amount of money, which of course is cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, but we have X amount of money, and you got to do this study. You can do it internationally, but you have to have the money where it would have just been done in the U.S. So that's what we did. We found a way to go to Vietnam, France, and the U.S., better known as Chicago, Paris, and Saigon. And we then were investigating personal space and mood. And, you know, we were, this is a horrible slide, and it's actually dictating from our report. You know, we're looking at what was personal space, how moods articulated, and to explore consumer practices within these, the strategies, routines, the practices in play, and all of that, with the implications for new product development. Now, mind you, I really, really, really believe that cross-cultural comparison for new product development is the way to go. Like, there's no question, because it's all about getting new ideas, open your mind, so it's like, go elsewhere to open your mind. So we ended up, we did this, and we recruited friends of friends, that's how we made it cheap. And if you look in the middle, there's Dominique, who's now in the audience. In the audience, we do have friends, Dominique. So, you know, so that's how we did the research in Paris. And then Christophe Robert, who's not here, unfortunately, but he's an anthropologist who did his work in Vietnam and is now still living there. He went to Saigon, and we had these initial group discussions of diary interviews. So that's what we did. And did we find anything out? That is, yes, we found out incredible things. This is just one of my favorite, you know, I'm almost out of time. Okay. My favorite thing was in France. I really love this. That whole personal sensorial space was really different. And from an American point of view, it was just great the way, you know, like taking the fan and the subway, and about the movement and gestures. It was about interaction with things and, you know, those tablecloths that are paper that you can write on. Or I think I just like the chairs that look like nobody came to your focus group room, but that you can move it. And, you know, fiddling in your purse is a way of relaxing. In Saigon, in our analysis, there were things like compensatory practices. You know, sometimes you have to make this stuff sound good. So, like, you know, if you were in a bad mood, you had a sort of compensation. And we never, if we had stayed in the U.S., would have come up with this idea that, you know, you can actually focus.
Right,
right. That's all right. Is that the timer? Is it done? Okay. Anyway, we never would have come up with, you could ride in traffic and you were in the flow, and that was, you know, great. It just wouldn't have happened. And I just keep doing this. So I was doing a meat project and just happened to be in Paris before, and I took all these great meat photos and tried to convince my client, or, you know, that the Cupid, the butchers all do that, like, one shoulder thing. Bruno probably likes that too. Yeah. And the photo that, like, you couldn't take if you were hoping for the snapshot, got the boucherie overcoat break between his head, like, I don't know how that happened. All right, so. Questions,
comments? Questions, comments? Hope we open it up to the floor. Any reactions, perhaps?
Yeah. I really like the whole idea of using different cultural contexts to open up the mind. Because I know in product development, so often there are many assumptions that are based on the local context. And ideas can come from anywhere. And it's a Meaning, have you done it before, or is this the first time?
The first time I just came out. I want to go to Ethiopia, and I want to go to Paris. You know, no, it was the first time, and I really try to sell it as to get ideas for here, or, you know, wherever here is, go elsewhere, right? And I haven't had a lot of luck, and for that meat project, it just happened to be that I was going to Paris. But then, I started, interviewing New York cab drivers. Every time I was in a cab, where's the best Ghanaian restaurant? Because you could do it just even, you could come up with great ideas for new frozen meat products. That's what this company was into. By just going to, the Senegalese restaurant and the Ghanaian restaurant. And I thought that would be kind of fun, too. To be, But it's real. And as I understand, I told this to a design firm, and they said, and they branded it, of course. That's our exploratory XYZ. We do that. And so they are able to get that, I haven't done it much. Yeah?
I'm curious to hear more about your experience in terms of selling Anthropology as a tool for product development and the reactions that you've had, what your process is for getting work and what the reactions you've had from business in terms of using ethnographic and other anthropological tools.
Well, I think myself and everyone on this panel and many people in the room, it absolutely is viable. It has worked for decades and decades, and companies know that. I mean, very often they know that. And they, there's kind of ethnography and there's anthropology, and it sort of depends which one is ascendant at that, and it kind of goes like this. But do they know that sort of an ethnographic or an they know an ethnographic view will help? That's not news. Specifically anthropological ethnography? Not always.
One more?
I think, again, everyone in the room went, we'll keep answering this. I think that there was a bit of a heyday for cultural analysis or anthropological research in the U.S. and some other people need to speak to Europe that is a little bit past, but really, it's like this. And it's past in the heyday in that, people just used to ask for it, not it was like the magic bullet. If we have this, and now sometimes other things are acting as the magic bullet. Big data or whatever is acting as the magical bullet, the magic bullet, and budgets. That's the recession did a number on budgets, and then you sort of get more for less. And I think we're all struggling. Are struggling with that because, but this project, and I would do it again. I mean, that's the dirty secret that's now recorded. We did this project for the amount of money that they were going to spend in the U.S. And it was a favorite client. It was a client we had done 25 projects with them. That's why I was so sick of, sent in the U.S. But, it was the same amount of money. But it worked because we did things instead of staying in hotels, we stayed with friends. We didn't use professional recruiters. We did friends. Dominique, what's also nice. Okay, I got to leave. She's telling me to go.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Powell is up next. From my perspective, she graduated from college 5 minutes ago. But it wasn't 5 minutes ago. She was explaining. She's going to talk about her journey, and I think for anybody who is interested in a career that begins with a bachelor's degree in anthropology, pay close attention to what Elizabeth has to say.
Thank you. So in the next 3 minutes, I'm going to take you through my personal journey with anthropology and business. my hope that I'll leave you with not simply a window into my life experience, but some thought to bring back to your personal and professional lives. I would have laughed if someone had told me I not only graduate from school with a degree in anthropology, but actually use that education in my professional life. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, but knowing I need a well-paying job coming out of school, I figured economics would be the most logical and relevant major. I'd never even heard of anthropology before school. However, I stumbled upon anthropology by way of Alan Mann's Food Waste course. I remember thinking I was in the wrong place when I came into a classroom and saw a glass case full of skulls lining the wall. But from Rio Everman's course on economics and cultural context, Carol Mouse's course on pop culture, to Alma Gottlieb's Women's Lives and Women's Bodies, with an anthropological degree in France sermon, I came to love anthropology. Despite the fact that anthropology is interesting but irrelevant, everyone knows that. Nonetheless, I made the decision to indulge in my academic passions and major in anthropology, knowing that I'd likely be sacrificing postgraduate job opportunities. In fact, Forbes told me that it was the least employable major. Great. While I loved my studies, I remember the tremendous anxiety I felt my senior year when it was career time. I was so envious of my peers that to tell employers economics, while I said anthropology, and their eyebrow raises and smirks. I'd even come up with a script to spin my major as relevant. I constructed a curriculum based on economics, sociology, and anthropology to be able to analyze and understand consumer behavior. However, my perception radically changed when I discovered a company actually looking for anthropologists at our career fair. Could that be right? Were they crazy? Though I didn't even know with a search in Google, I got back to my room in a flurry, looking to see if this could be a real thing. It actually sparked my senior thesis, in which I focus on anthropologists who work in business. It is a real thing, it turns out. Through my interviews with 20 incredible anthropologists who work in business, a number of whom are in this room, I discovered the invaluable contribution of an anthropological lens in the business world. So what about me? How did my education play out in the real world? I'm shocked and thrilled to tell you that I think about and use my anthropological education and my thesis work every single day in my world of innovation, branding, and consumer research. Take my most recent experience, for example. I joined a brand strategy and innovation firm called RedCrop, which does incredible work for clients like Google, Pepsi, Diageo, Bloomingdale's, lots of others. And transitioning into the role of key success is being able to understand and navigate the unique political, sociocultural context, language, behaviors, rituals, all of that at the company. Luckily, anthropologists are experts at understanding new cultural contexts. Then on my first project, I kicked off on a 10-market global study, where I led consumer ethnographies in LA, Singapore, and Paris, in order to help the biggest startup out there that needs the most brand help, you can imagine which that is, help reorient to a true, meaningful, and long-lasting brand purpose. I was easily able to dive into cultural nuance while still recognizing common threads throughout. Anthropology again came to the fore when I dove into understanding the unique client politics, culture, and dynamics, which is critical to getting any great idea actually in the market. So it's often overlooked. I can give many more examples, but what's consistent is that while I may not regularly say things like totems and kinship and full exchange of work, anthropology is integral to my day-to-day. I'm deeply grateful for my anthropological education. However, I'm concerned that we still live in a cultural system in which anthropology is not common sense for business roles. After all, isn't anthropology a lens for understanding slices of humanity and perhaps in doing so better grasping greater humanity? From craft, then anthropology is a methodological, analytical, theoretical approach applicable and valuable in any context involving humans. And aren't businesses, at their core, groups of humans serving other humans? If so, then who better to be in the conversation than an anthropologist? I may be an idealist, but I can envision a future in which anthropology, not economics, is the obvious and most logical major for someone intending to go into business or any context. I hope for a day in which anthropology students won't need to spend their major. Simply saying anthropology will be valuable for the tremendous contribution it can bring to any and every context. and they'll have confidence in that. Not only does this mean more career opportunities for academic anthropology, but I believe it can also lead to a more humane, respectful, and empathetic world.
There must be some questions for some people here who want to start with the real ones. I'll start with a question.
Oh, there's one.
Oh, go ahead.
Can you say a little bit more about Red Scout, what the company does, and when you say a 10 market global study, can you just give a little glance at that, or who's on the ground, or people cooperating with multi-sites, following the regulations?
Sure. So Red Scout, it's a brand strategy and innovation firm, which means that in an ideal project, a client would come to us, could be across industries, and they would be looking for a higher order purpose that would actually connect emotionally with consumers, and that would guide everything they do internally and externally. After setting that purpose, we would then create services, products, experiences internally and externally that would deliver on that. In terms of the 10 market global study, so consumer research is one piece of various work streams we use in any project. But for this consumer work, we had 3 weeks, 10 markets. So we were in 3 cities in the US, Singapore, Jakarta, New Delhi, Sao Paulo, Mexico City, Paris, France. Or Paris, London, a few others, I think. But we were going into homes and talking to consumers about their lives generally, and then drilling down, of course, as an anthropologist would, into the more specifics. So if there's anything else that's helpful.
So building on the 2 presentations, how does your company do that? Hire other companies in these other countries, or do they have, you know, offices? Like, how they actually do the work themselves out?
So at my last company, we had 8 offices globally. At the current one, it's in New York and the West Coast. We have 1 small one in London. But this project, it was entirely done from the New York team. And so from my core team, there was a representative in each market at any given time. And we led the research. We led the analysis. We partnered with firms who helped with the recruits and things like that, but we were actually on the ground in each of these markets.
We have someone.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask a question about the way, since I did kind of work up the challenge a little bit. You ended on that. You want to put on the idea that what we do is bring in more demand than influencer businesses. And you do brand demand and strategy work. And the project you described about is maybe a software and perception. How much of what you were doing was going to inform how they do their practices rather than how people perceive what they do? And is that something that you think, do you think that in your experience, that there are different skills for kind of the consumer outlook for doing the same stuff compared to the inward focusing on how to engage a company and how to reach into its own practices and maybe wants to offer in the US?
Sure, that's totally fair, and I've been giving it a lot of thought. For me, what was attractive about this company is that it's not simply setting a brand strategy that's maybe going to connect with consumers, but they're doing the exact same thing that they were doing before. What's impactful to me is that there's the innovation piece, and that means that we set a purpose, which has some truth to their DNA, of course. But based on that purpose, they are making changes. So this company, for example, we just presented a new mission statement for them, and they're going to be changing how they approach their employees, how they do their onboarding. All of the internal practices are going to be impacted by this brand purpose, because theoretically it should guide everything they do, all behaviors, all actions, all ways of working together internally, and how they show up in the world. So it's not just communications, and it's not I don't get excited by something that's just selling people something they don't need or just changing the way something sounds or comes across. It actually is inside out, outside in.
Thank you.
Oh.
So Chris Miller is going to talk about another career option here, the convergence of design and anthropology.
Okay. Well, good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning about design anthropology. Tim, Bob, this is really great, and the presentations already are really exciting. So I am Chris Miller. I'm from the Stewart School of Business at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. So I am on the academic side. So for Elizabeth, yeah, I'm in the business school teaching design and anthropology. So let's see. All right, so what is it? What is design anthropology? So I'm going to read us through this one. Design anthropology is a transdisciplinary field that has emerged as a result of the evolution of two disciplines, design and anthropology, and their convergence within commercial, organizational, and social arenas. And it's interesting that here in the U.S., business anthropology, design anthropology is kind of seen as a subset of that, whereas in Europe, it is seen as a unique and distinct discipline, really. And so kind of interesting on that. All right, so how did these two fields come together? Anthropology, as we know, has been through major paradigmatic shifts in the 20th and now in the 21st century. First, reevaluating that we no longer are the science of study of the faraway other, and then reevaluating what is it that we really do and why do we do it. Keith Murphy yesterday said, like, I wake up doing anthropology in the morning. That's what a lot of us feel, like we wake up doing it. Reinventing what is an anthropology of the contemporary, relocating in new fields of anthropological inquiry, like business, for example, and now with design anthropology, actually reimagining and looking into possible futures as an extension of our ethnographic gaze. So these are like ethnographies of the possible. I want to talk a little bit about that. So beyond observation and description of what is, which is what traditionally anthropology has done, anthropology becomes exploratory, it becomes experimental, and it becomes transformative, adopting emerging design processes and design tools with our anthropological critical look and theory and our research methodologies to imagine what might be, to collectively imagine what might be. So on the design side, what happened? So this is a really neat graph. It's eye candy up here, but I'm happy to share it with you. It's very cool. It shows how design has moved from object-centered to human-centered and now to humanity-centered design and how it continues to evolve. So what we see here in this red circle is where anthropology and anyway, this is where anthropology came into design. So design, they recognize their influences and they pull them in and they recontextualize them. So when I talked about this slide with Elizabeth the other day, she goes, oh, where's design anthropology? You know, when you have Liz Sanders and Jane Bruce Fulton, like, where are the design anthropologists there? So I at least extended the line, because this ends at 2010, and design anthropology is happening. Anthropology, business, and design, what can we do with this field, right? And where can we go with this? So for me, teaching, you can teach in a business school like I do, IIT, Fordham, have anthropologists in the business school. You can teach at a design school. You can go into medical school like Vanderbilt, engineering school, Wayne State, where Julia is. You could go into applied technology, anthropology departments like UNT, Wayne State, and so what I'm doing here is just kind of showing the opportunities. And when I started to think about this, it's like there's a lot of opportunities for moving anthropology into other fields that touch on business. You can go directly into business and industry, and many examples here, only naming a few. You can go to work for a design firm. You can go into a corporation like Intel or Microsoft or Samsung or MetLife, nonprofit organizations and government organizations like the VA or the GAO. And then there's also many people here actually have taken an entrepreneurial approach and are self-employed and have their own firms. Okay, I am almost done. I'm going to show you my own career path. This is where I was. This is what actually happened. So I started out with a BA in Art and Humanities. I then got an MA in Japan-U.S. Relations. This is where my business started happening. I have an almost MBA. I matriculated into an interdisciplinary PhD program. I then went to teach in a design school and design management faculty, and now I'm in a business school, right? So it doesn't ever come out the way you think it should. But just to close, you know, some ideas for those of you that might be thinking about it, I think most of the people here are already there. But if you're thinking about moving from anthropology to, business, leverage your talents and skills. We have them. Think about what you can contribute. How can you add value? And invest in learning. You know, be strategic. Be flexible. Be open. And be curious. And then tap your networks. Reach out and explore the options. Do what we always do when you go into a new field, right? You're respectful. You learn the language. You observe the locals. You're there to learn, not to lecture, and do good work. Thank you.
Questions right away. Yes.
Is this kind of an extension of anthropometry?
An extension, yes, but a lot of design anthropology is really truly transdisciplinary. Right? So you may have designers that consider themselves design anthropologists, they have no formal training in anthropology. Engineers, same thing. It's taking those two fields and experimenting with how they could work together. Right? So it really is a transdisciplinary field. You don't have to be an anthropologist to be a design anthropologist. And you don't have to be a designer to be a design anthropologist. But they're all science.
Another question? So I had one of those funny career already as pretty young. So before I went back to graduate school, I ended up in politics and worked at the Senate, and then eventually became a lobbyist for 4 years. But I found...
Stumbled into it.
Yeah, right. So, well, the whole system is accidental and really old school. But one of my questions is that in terms of applying design to things like processes and policy and the way that government and actually government and business for a while, so I looked at how they interact, you see more of an appetite to go beyond that object-centered, product-centered focus to really look at how do we make starting a small business not be a nightmare for people and all that?
Yeah. I see that happening a lot on the design side, and it's actually what really attracted me to design anthropology was being able to work with designers who are moving, they're out of the object-centered thing. I mean, industrial design is still focused on an object, but even in that sense, they look at the object not in isolation, but in a network of actors, right? So so as they're moving, they're getting out of the object-centered, they've talked about human-centered design for a long time, and now humanity-centered. They're really pushing out, and design research is becoming very important, so they're really into that. And I see them as being very progressive and very open and hungry, you know, for moving into that. So, yeah. Oh, Julia.
And related to that, would you say that design anthropology is moving towards a focus on process as well as objects, or
That's interesting. You know, not so much. You know, designers are very focused on process, and I think that one of the things that anthropology contributes to design is to break that, like, lockstep process. I mean, they talk about it being iterative, but there's still this framework that they work within, and I think...
focusing on understanding processes and
okay.
designing processes.
On the designing side.
Like in organizations, for example.
Yes. Yes, but I think that anthropology will lead that. I don't think design is going to lead that. And again, it's one of the nice things about the two fields coming together.
We can have one more question.
One more? Okay.
Hi. So what I see is happening is there may even be an evolution in design anthropology where going from object even to services. And so in services, you have an analysis of contact points. You have an analysis of sort of the blueprint of how the service is laid out. So, you know, it goes from hard to soft.
Yeah, and service design, of course, is a very big field right now, and anthropology has a lot to contribute to that. Yeah, yeah. But I think anthropology makes design go deeper. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Thank you. For those of you who are going after Derek, you can sit up here. Doing a musical chair. Patricia Ensworth is, I feel like saying that she's in the same business as James Bond because risk is her business. But she's going to talk about risk management, which is an area of business anthropology that we haven't really thought so much as being a part of business anthropology, but it really is. So.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. And thank you, Bob and Tim, for inviting me to be part of this great group. I am a management consultant. And I lead management training workshops for the American Management Association.
Can you speak louder?
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm a management consultant. I lead management training workshops for the American Management Association. And I teach at New York University. So I'm kind of in both camps, as well as in academia. And taking a cue from the title of our sessions here, Business Anthropology Matters, let's continue our exploration of the question, exactly how does anthropology matter to business? Fundamentally, what matters to business, and how can anthropology help? In my experience, more than anything, business leaders hate surprises. Budgets, schedules, resource allocations, operating logistics, supply chains, all of these are established weeks, months, quarters, years in advance, and any unexpected changes caused there can be additional costs, delays, loss of customers, damage to reputation. Whatever the impact, it's bad news. So some of the unpredictable events like Category 5 Hurricane Maria in the Caribbean or the Boston Marathon bombing are so rare and catastrophic that nobody could plan ahead for them. Other kinds of events, like the outcome of an election, or the impact of a corporate reorganization, create a kind of foreseeable instability that can be managed with response strategies. And some other kinds of events, like fluctuations in markets or variations in production output, are addressed through contingency budgets. Risk management is the professional discipline that prepares businesses to deal with those unpredictable events in the future. So at the strategic executive level of the organization, risk management applies things like data analytics and probability theory and behavioral theory and statistical models to understand various metrics for the purpose of ensuring that a business protects its assets and its cash flow. The experts who perform this kind of work are usually economists, mathematicians, and other species of quantitative analysts. However, at the level of the products that are being built, the services that are being deployed, the operations that are staying functional, risk management is really all about people. The practice does involve some specialized concepts, methodologies, and techniques, but fundamentally it's an ethnographic exercise in cross-cultural communication among stakeholders who bring their different perspectives to the process. The goal is the same for ethnographers as it is for the class: avoid those surprises and figure out what to do if in fact they actually happen. So beginning when I was in graduate school, the focus of my professional life has been risk management on business projects to implement innovative technologies for internal employees and external customers. Typically, my work falls under the categories of project requirements definition and or quality assurance and or user experience research. But to each of these categories, it adds another dimension. Requirements definition asks what the deliverables will look like and how they'll behave. Ethnography asks how those deliverables will change people's lives. Quality assurance asks what objective standards the deliverables will need to meet and who will verify that. Ethnography asks how do people perceive quality. User experience research asks people to describe their tactile sensations, their cognitive processes, and their emotional responses. Ethnography asks people to describe, to articulate their values and their beliefs. So in addition to broadening the field of vision, ethnography encourages project sponsors to expand the range of stakeholders who will participate in the risk identification, prioritization, and remediation process. I think anthropologists have earned a well-deserved reputation for our expertise in engaging with communities who may be marginalized or disempowered. So ensuring that those voices are heard during the design phase of a project can significantly reduce the probability of those unpleasant surprises occurring during rollout. During the past 30 years, I've worked on a range of technology projects that have both created and responded to cultural changes in internal employee work processes and external customer relationships. Some have taken a proactive approach to reducing the probability of risk, and some have taken a reactive approach to mitigating the damage. As a result, from my experience, studying anthropology, I think, turned out to be a worthwhile investment. Combined with other types of professional skills, the prospects for a job seeker with an anthropology degree and an interest in business, I think, can be quite bright. Risk management for products and services and operations is a natural fit. It matters to business, and anthropologists, I think, can succeed by taking those matters into our own hands. Thank you.
Risk management is an important thing, and there are people already in the field, lawyers. How do you deal with that problem? You talked about economists, you didn't have the economists.
That's a great question. So lawyers certainly focus on risk management, and they, in my experience, tend to do so from an understanding of laws and of insurance policies and of the impact on specific types of clients and their experience based on the clients they have dealt with. So I have worked with lawyers, and coming back to the question of anthropology and the voices of communities who may be powerless or marginalized, I think in many cases pointing out that even though those populations may not be able to afford lawyers, they do matter in the delivery of a product or service.
Question. I did a little bit of work in this space when I was in the industry on risk, and the impression I had of the issue is that the banks are the most sophisticated at it, and there's sort of a spectrum of quantitative to qualitative in how they approach risk management, right? So the most quantitative end is things like credit default risk models, and then on the more qualitative end would be their internal operational risk model, evaluating the risk of an insider lead or something. How have you found sort of anthropology, where have you kind of situated your kind of ethnographic approach within that spectrum of kind of already established kind of risk management?
So thinking about the kind of quantitative risk analysis, for example, at banks, in some financial services organizations, risk management means, okay, we can't deal with all of the possible threats. Let's just gamble and see, you know, what will we mess up remediation efforts. But I think in that instance, what anthropology I found has brought to the conversation is focusing on what I think anthropologists often call social sciences, taboo subjects. For example, I had a great project once in IT security after a cyber war that attacked one bank. And the key issue that we had to deal with was who trusted whom. That was not documented. That was not something that could be approached by quantitative analysis. And using the time-honored anthropological techniques of hanging out, participant observation, and going to the social events, you know, where people who shouldn't really have been sharing passwords with each other, but got to trust you enough to talk about when it would be necessary to bend the rules and break the rules, turned out to be a really important aspect of that project.
So the client only did that after they had a bad check.
Yeah, risk management tends to happen when something bad has already happened.
Right.
And people don't want to have it happen to them, or the organization doesn't want to have it happen to them.
Thank you. Moving right along here. Mike Youngblood, do you have slides?
There's just one.
Okay. One slide.
I wasn't sure if we were doing slides or not.
Which one is it? This one. Got it. Nice picture to look at.
Yeah, something we're going to have to look at.
So Mike's going to be discussing positioning anthropology as a partner in sustainable business.
So,
welcome.
Thank you. How is this? Can you hear?
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about partnering with business for becoming more sustainable. I think business leaders have been increasingly feeling pressured to demonstrate their commitment to earth-friendly and people-friendly practices. There's in a 2016 McKinsey & Company Global Survey, about 36% of global CEOs surveyed reported that sustainability was among their top three strategic initiatives, strategic priorities. There were 13% of the CEOs surveyed who said that it was their number one priority. Okay, now that doesn't seem super high, 13%, considering sort of the problems that we're facing, but that's up from 3% in 2010. So there is a market movement there. So essentially, growing numbers of corporations are realizing that sustainable practices can be good for business and that they're valued by the society around them. It helps them, among other things, cut costs, improve employee satisfaction with their jobs, improve their reputations, and in many cases stay a few steps ahead of incoming government regulations that they see coming down the pike, and allowing them to be leaders in their space and getting ahead of others. But business leaders, I've found, often find it really hard to envision the breadth of the kinds of things that they can tackle to improve their impact on people and the planet, and some of the most effective ways to bring those things to life. Aside from just sort of the obvious things like moving to wind power and being more vigilant about inspecting your sweatshops and things like that. And this is where I see a really big opening for anthropologists, because I think we have this kit of methods and perspectives that enables us to approach things like sustainability in a different way and to have an interesting conversation and partnership with business. And so I want to briefly call out a few of the things that I think are unique, distinctive capabilities that we have as a discipline that we could be bringing to that conversation. And so the first is our critical reflexivity. As we all know, our discipline is endlessly fascinated with the ethical and epistemological implications of our own presence in the work we do, and our footprint in the world, in the work. Corporations, on the other hand, as we a lot of us would guess if we don't actually know from working with them, they tend to think very linearly, and as organizations, they spend very little time questioning their outcomes and impacts in the world that don't tie in directly and obviously with profit and loss. I don't think that comes necessarily from callous disregard for those things, but I think it's more a reflection of the daily demands of just doing business, which rewards conclusiveness and resolute action. So it's a culture that doesn't allow much time for introspection. But as anthropologists, we're really predisposed to introspection and we're adept at it. And I think we can bring some of that sort of instinctual capability of ours to business to help them reflect on their ways that are kind of that are unexpected. Not just saying, hey, you're polluting the sky, but there are lots of other things going on here that may be complicated and worthy of consideration. And I think in doing so, we can help them uncover new opportunities for taking leadership in sustainability and moving toward more responsible versions of themselves, especially in spaces where they wouldn't think to look. And that's why I want to bring in the second capability that I think is really powerful, and that's our holistic and systemic way of thinking about things. And most business leaders that I've encountered are accustomed to thinking about their business and the world around them and their impact in that world in very reductive frames. They're taught to think in terms of distinct verticals, in terms of departmental goals, in terms of budgetary line items, and so forth. This rejectivism, it constrains businesses' potential for conscientious change, not just constraining potential for really transformative change, but I think it also constrains the potential for significant incremental change, which is sometimes the best we can hope for some industries like the oil industry, for example. Many negative and social impacts for business are really hard to see because they are systemic, and they're determined by compounding factors of multiple practices across an organizational whole. And if businesses can't get their heads around those interconnected facets of their practice, it's really difficult for them to see the problem and imagine the ways out of it. They can't be expected to come up with really far-reaching solutions. And of course, we're adept at this kind of thinking as well, this holistic and systemic thinking. And I think we should be putting this, forward in our interactions. And I won't go into the last one, but I think our because it's been covered by some of the others, but I think our Edic and Emic distinctions of what's going on out there and how people feel and experience things are very important as well for imagining new solutions and imagining how the footprint of business practice sort of impacts people in their communities and in their environments. So I'll leave it at that, and this isn't an exhaustive list of capabilities, nor are they strictly applicable to the sustainability challenge, but I think these are things we could be putting forward in a new effort to work with business for sustainability.
I was interested in how you approach the differences between being proactive and being reactive in business when you're approaching in terms of sustainability. Is that imagine two different conversations, two different types of conversations depending on the company and how that approach is.
I think different organizations have different capacities to sort of proact versus react. And reactive is more the standard mode, because when a problem starts to emerge or the public starts to notice the problem or regulators, that's when they can marshal resources to respond. So I think one thing that we can really help with is that proactive part, sort of like getting organizations to spend some time really examining themselves and finding problems that can be addressed probably before they get harder to address, sort of making relatively micro changes in the way they practice their business in order to cut things off before they get really advanced in business. I'll let Tim call you. Here you go.
Yes.
This also goes to Tony's. This is a topic that's dear to my heart, and you started to touch on the question of Edic Emic in your last one. without going into full out detail, but Patty also got into the question of contrasting culture settings that you being able to go deep into it. And now, in terms of the proactive, to what extent do you go and speak to clients and suggest that they go to engage and really internalize the e-mix and really meet with the clients? With the contextual situation that their corporations are in a position to adapt.
Yeah, it's something I'm trying to figure out how to do, because I think this is a very new space. We heard from some of the other panelists, the industry has for quite some time now, at least a couple of decades, been very interested in embracing the value of anthropological perspectives and the way we work and the way we sort of tease out sort of other people's point of view and find insight in that. But mostly in the space where they're creating products, service, marketing, those kinds of things. I haven't seen much interest in that, in analyzing their impact in the world, their possible negative impact in the world. I'm trying to find ways to bring that conversation to bear. I think there is a lot of opportunity, and you see, for example, some oil companies, for example, are starting to take a lot of interest in how their business practices are affecting communities that live in oil exploration areas, or the microprocessor industry is starting to look at sort of heavy metals, rare earth metal mining, and the fate of the miners and so forth. But it's new, and I think we can really help bring that further along.
Thank you. We're going to move on to Derek Newberry. These are 5-minute presentations. We have time for a couple of questions. But everyone is encouraged to approach the speakers after the session and have more conversation.
5 minutes is tough, I'll tell you. I feel like we need the. Does anyone remember the Dave Chappelle Wrap It Up? A couple of you. Hello. All right. So I sort of crossed the academic applied divide in that I'm an adjunct professor, but I also do quite a bit of leadership development consulting through the Wharton School. And that's really cool for me because I spend a lot of time talking to corporate leaders about what they want their organizations to learn. And that matters because what they want to learn tells you a lot about what they care about, right? What they think actually drives their organizations. And I can tell you that in my world of leadership development, right now, what business leaders care about is storytelling. That seems to be a really critical skill. And I think what's going on is that they're increasingly recognizing that their own icons also happen to be great storytellers. And this is no coincidence, right? It's no coincidence that great storytellers happen to be very influential in organizations because stories themselves are influential, right? And so why is that? Well, we know that narrative is a really powerful medium. And this is a historian, Yuval Harari, here summarizing a lot of research on the subject when he proposes that storytelling may even be the unique skill that separates us as a species. And we as anthropologists don't need historians and business leaders to tell us that, right? We already sort of know that. We know that narrative is not just a powerful medium, but a medium of power, right? So why do we love Foucault so much? Remember in graduate school, we had this joke that if the paper is no good, you just sprinkle a little Foucault on it. As I'm doing here, to be honest. Allow me to sprinkle some Foucault. Well, so what did he remind us of? He reminds us that power works through our ability to shape dominant narratives and to tell our own stories, right? To shape our own narratives and not internalize other people's narratives that they would impose on us. Okay, so why does this matter? Well, I teach in my own storytelling workshops that every good story has at least two critical elements to it. Some sort of a challenge and then a resolution to that challenge. And I believe in this story, our challenge as anthropologists is that even though we understand the power of shaping narrative, we're abdicating our ability to shape dominant narratives in the business world. And I mean that in a couple of ways. First of all, by often refusing to engage the business community, we lose our ability to shape dominant narratives about what good corporate citizenship looks like, about ethics in corporations. And to me, this is absolutely baffling. It's just open headlines. Look at any one of the number of corporate scandals right now, from Uber to Wells Fargo and others. We always chalk it up to corporate culture, right? And so these companies should be calling us to help them solve their problems, right? And it's a real problem that we're not part of that conversation. Now, the flip side of that is that we also lose our ability to shape dominant narratives about our own discipline. Let me just give you a quick example. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was giving a talk at an investment bank. And before I went on stage, when I was just talking to those folks at my table, they didn't realize I was one of the speakers. I said I was an anthropologist, and one of them says, "Oh, anthropologist, that's interesting. So you're sort of like Ross from Friends, right?" I said, "Not quite. Ross is a paleontologist. Also, he's by far and away the worst character on Friends, so thank you." But I get this all the time, and that drives me crazy. It should automatically click with people. Oh, anthropology, you're a culture person. That's what you do. Okay. And so I said that every good story has both a challenge and a resolution. Well, I don't know the resolution to this story, but I have an idea of how I'd like it to end. And basically what I'm going to argue is that we need to start telling better stories. And I mean that in a couple of ways. First of all, I think it starts with our graduate students. We have to empower them to craft their own narratives about their careers rather than imposing our narratives on them. And so what I mean is that too often in departments, we tell our graduate students explicitly and implicitly that if they don't go into tenure track, academic tracks, that they're failures, right? Then we hear that too often. So we need to enlarge the array of career narratives that are open to them. Second, I would argue that the other side of that is we have to be attentive to the stories we tell in departments because those stories establish role models for our students. We tend to tell stories about the successful tenure track academics, but not about the students who go into marketing or consulting. So we need to tell those stories. We need to tell more stories about prominent organizational and business anthropologists, like the folks here, keynote speaker, Jillian Tett, Genevieve Bell, and of course my distinguished co-panelists. And lastly, of course, we need to tell more stories in the business community about what anthropology is and what it can do for businesses. So these are just some ideas, but ultimately I would argue that how this story ends is really up to us. If we don't start telling better stories, I believe our discipline will fade into irrelevance, and corporate leaders won't shed any tears about that. It'll ultimately be our problem. It'll be our mistake. But I believe this story can have a better ending. I believe we have the ability to create a lot of positive change in a corporate world that desperately needs it right now, if only we will seize that opportunity. And I look forward to discussing with you ways to do that. Thank you.
To me, it seems sort of like a chicken and the egg problem in terms of involving business. And so I'm curious what your experience has been in terms of having businesses care about an anthropologist's perspective and how you're able to contribute yourself to the perspective of anthropology in business.
Yeah, I'm sure others have different perspectives on this, but to me, right now, at this particular stage, you know, anthropology is taking off in certain areas, so design and in marketing in particular, anthropology has more cachet. But for me, as somebody who's more frequently focused internally on consulting organizations on managing their own cultures, it tends to start with a culture problem. And then me talking about my ability to solve culture problems in anthropology kind of comes in after that. But it really starts with the problem solving, not with, you know, going out and branding myself as an anthropologist. That's less common in time. And I'd like to change that, right? I think that's really important.
As far as getting the narrative out about what we do and the positive stories, there's a growing nexus of podcasters in anthropology. So if you haven't already seen it, it's worth a glimpse. And would you consider contributing to one and telling some stories on a podcast?
I would. I mean, I think we need to be more involved, as I said, in shaping public narratives, and that involves public media. So I, myself, am a contributor to Entrepreneur, to Fortune. I try to do as much popular writing as I can, even though it means nothing on the academic track. And quick plug, I know we also have a podcast that can, right, Erica? The Anthropology Podcast.
I'm involved in the
Okay, it exists out there. But anyway, yes, absolutely, and I think we should be doing more of that sort of thing.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Our next speaker, Joseph Weiland, is going to talk about commodity anthropology in the business of relationships.
Good morning. It's nice to be here. I appreciate being asked to participate in this panel. Presently, I'm straddling the boundary between anthropology in academia and anthropology in business. I'm currently finishing my PhD at the University of California, Irvine, and I presently work at Red Associates in New York in Copenhagen. So today I'm going to talk about how my work in graduate school has translated into a career in business anthropology. I'm still kind of tethered to academic anthropology, so forgive, it's going to be a big one. In chapter 1 of Capital, Marx wrote that a commodity appears at first sight, a very trivial thing and easily understood. Its analysis shows that in reality it's clear to him abounding in metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. Over a century later, Audrey and Potterite declared that all efforts at defining commodities are doomed to sterility unless they illuminate commodities' emotion. Follow the commodity studies and track everything from rocks to Sony Walkman, showing how global goods are imbued with cultural meaning as they pass through and co-produce social landscapes. However, despite a century worth of such insights and theory, much of this knowledge remains untapped by the actual people responsible for sending goods to market. Enter the anthropologist. In its flash paper, I dropped my work as a strategy consultant with Red Associates and for my dissertation, following quartz crystals from illicit mines in Brazil to New Age energy healers in California, to draw out two areas where anthropology offers unique value to commodity-based businesses. First, relationship building, and second, weaving a tapestry of perspectives. As Timothy Malkuth has observed, ethnographic insight into how commodities are valued and used offers a particular form of power in business, which we are only beginning to harness. So, perspectives are actually relationships. Beyond focusing on the production and movement of objects themselves, anthropology's greatest contribution to commodity studies is our insight into relationships. This includes relations between actors, relations between people and objects, relations between people and markets themselves. While anthropologists have helped illuminate the constellation of cultural practices, intersubjective experiences, and market logics that converge within global goods, we matter to businesses precisely because we understand that commodities, like gifts, are often predicated on powerful social ties. So from 2012 to 2013, I conducted ethnographic research in the global commodity chain spanning from illicit quartz miners in Brazil to New Age energy healers in California in order to track how different forms of social, spiritual, and economic value are generated. As I moved through this commodity stage, I helped my informants create new connections with each other. I linked miners and buyers in Brazil, I connected wholesalers and healers in the American Southwest, and my personality granted me an overview of this commodity state and enabled me to help differently positioned actors understand each other's relationships to crystals, to each other, and even to New Age metaphysics. At its core, market building is about relationship building, and our unique vantage point as participants observers enables us to tilt the axis of power within markets, or at least help infuse some sort of futurity or mutual obligation into them. So the second area is about perspectives. In his ethnography of the globalization of Coca-Cola, Robert Foster has suggested that anthropologists look at, quote, globalized commodity or value chains as networks not only of production and exchange, but also of perspectives, as networks of perspectives on other people's perspectives, unquote. At Red Associates, we often find that it's the disjuncture within these networks of perspectives that makes value creation possible. This past summer, Red partnered with a client looking to shape the world's obstructive sleep apnea treatment market. And rather than framing our research around our clients' concerns, how to sell more sleep apnea machines, we recast the business problem as a human phenomenon sleeping well. Through our research in China, Hong Kong, Germany, France, and Brazil, the client joined us as we spoke with sales reps, retailers, physicians, nurses, and patients and their families to understand how sleeping well was imagined and experienced differently by these actors. Exploring these different sleep ecologies, we were able to draw out the discord between prescribers, suppliers, patients' perspectives on sleep,
and thus offer our client a new strategic direction. Our team of anthropologists demonstrated the explicit value in understanding the ontology of sleep and help shape new offerings, new services, and new ways of framing sleep as a seemingly universal phenomenon. This may seem obvious to us, but it was groundbreaking for our client. Thank you.
Questions? Comments?
Yeah, I have a question about your experience at RED. I mean, RED is well known, and I think it's been one of the very successful anthropology-oriented marketing careers. So I wonder if you have any advice about how it is that RED's been able to grow this business and become very, what seems to be, outside, very stable business. You know, where the challenge sometimes is when you're providing the cultural piece of something or the ethnographic piece of it. You're a boutique piece of a much bigger kind of marketing strategy or something, right? And then at some point you're like, oh, the company goes behind you, like, well, we don't really need this boutique piece, we'll just save a little money, right? So what kind of like the business aspects of how it's been so successful?
Branding matters. And I think that RED has done a fantastic job of branding itself. This includes being very attuned to aesthetics and also being very plugged into which type of narratives are going to resonate with which types of clients.
All right, we're going to move on. We're getting a little tight. So. This is a priority, so we're talking about first impressions.
Hi everyone, I'm Elizabeth Friday. Glad to be here. It's a really great panel that Bob and Tim put together. I thought I would just focus on first impressions based on people's home pages of their websites and see what we can learn from that. Wait a minute. So, in the abstract for the session, there was a specific set of topics we could focus on. One focusing on what's in the box. And in particular, I'm going to be looking at home pages of five different professional associations and five business anthropology organizations and see if there's something that we can learn from both of those. If you look at the literature on mission statements, for example, there's a model that appears in much of the literature that goes from your vision and mission through your values and goals right up to your outcomes. And a lot of that is shown on homepages in various ways. And what we get at is a sense of identity of what the website is about through its home page, and we also get a sense of ideology, the aspirations that the site purports to focus on. And so, given that, I thought, let's just take a look at some things. So, the first thing I thought was, let's take a look and see if anything about the mission of the organization is apparent. And it turns out that indeed, it is that both the blue areas, the professional associations, as well as the anthropology businesses, do a pretty good job on their homepage of showing what they're all about in terms of mission. And they do it in two ways. One is a straight shot statement, and another way is they tie a little phrase to their logo. But they are less good on defining who they are. And I'm going to pick on Napa, not because I don't love Napa. I do. I was past president of Napa, but it's illustrative of what the issue can be. So, for example, if you go to the Napa homepage and ask, what is Napa, it will tell you what the acronym means, but it doesn't tell you anything beyond that. And then, moreover, if you start investigating what is the domain of Napa, it turns out it is practice, but what's that? That's not defined. So we often have a problem with definition. Then there's this other issue that some phrases are not terribly specific. on home pages. And so, for example, if you look down, these are all the professional associations. They're a little bit vague. They don't really get right to the point of what people do. But if you look at the anthropology businesses, wow, they are on it. They are very action-oriented, and you can see the words that are bolded. And then let's take a look at the last thing, which are themes. So there are lots of themes that are reflected on the professional association homepages. And some of them are even shared. So, for example, annual meetings is a big one at this time of year. But when you compare the professional associations with the anthropology businesses, the businesses have over twice as many themes as the professional associations. And so some of the things that they call out are things like culture, what a word, implementation, customer, and those kinds of things turn out to be very important. So what did we learn from this little analysis? I think we learned a few things. One is that the aspirations or the missions of a given organization can be very powerful if they target both your current audience as well as a prospective audience. And the point here is that we don't often, as professional associations especially, target prospective audience. A second point is that when you do a nice job of combining your logo with a little phrase, like Mike Youngblood did and the American Anthropological Association did, it's actually quite a powerful way of talking a little bit about who you are. I thought that worked really well. A third point is that when you use action-oriented verbs or phrases to convey what it is that you do, you end up showing a sense of energy and enthusiasm, just like you would see on a resume. And then the last point is that more themes, I think, are better than fewer. And the more themes show up on the business anthropology web pages, because that does two things. It shows the audience looking at your homepage what your emphasis is, what your skill set is, your capabilities. And at the same time, it demonstrates that you know who your customers are. Thank you. Yeah. Hello.
Hello. So last week I was trying to write an assignment using NAPA and the Society for Applied Ethical Pages.
Yes.
And the question that arose is, why are there two of them?
Right.
I was not able to resolve that.
They're yeah.
Statements or
so you got to talk to the natives. Okay, well, so it goes back a long way to 1941 when the SFAA and the AAA parted ways. And we can get into a further discussion of that.
Hi, Elizabeth. One of the things I thought about as I was watching your presentation was how we're very interested in semiotics.
Yes.
Anthropology. But where are the semiotics in these homepages?
They are not in the homepages very much. Okay, sorry. Very much, I say
about.
But a lot of that stuff appears typically under an about page. So that's usually a second click. But, for example, I think now I'm going to pick on the AAA, you have to do four clicks to get to the critical semiotic stuff. So it's probably better if you can push some of that to the homepage, because some people are not going to do four clicks, period.
Yeah. What do you think about the use of image? I mean,
I know, just didn't have enough time. It was spotty in both cases. There were no differences between the professional associations and the anthropology businesses. Some had photos, some did not.
Do you find a real difference in between economists or groups that are considered really influential? Were their pages better?
I didn't. The only outside non-anthropology association I looked at were the psychologists, the American Psychological Association, and theirs is not bad.
In your sample, I was curious why you didn't look at Epic, at the Epic website.
You know, I just figured I only have enough space on a slide for 5 and 5. So, no good reason. I did include the museum anthropologist because I thought they were relatively close to practice.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Alan, yes.
Bring yours up here.
Use his charisma. Alan Bateau, technical charisma.
Technological.
Technological charisma. It's all yours.
Thank you. We'll talk about a number of hard acts to follow. It's all been very exciting, and I'm sure this, what I have to present will be a kind of anticlimactic. But what I want to present very briefly is that this word technology, which we fetishize so much, really has layers of meaning that are hidden, but it's kind of a charismatic legitimation for the modern corporate form. So what I want to problematize in just a few minutes is both technology and the corporate form. Okay, in terms of technology, okay, I look at technology in terms of different layers, the architectural, the operational, and the inspirational perspectives. The architectural is the contribution to the built environment, including the ambient commons, the unstructured information around us. I mean, one thing that IT has done is given us all kinds of new information. We're flooded with information, with LED billboards and so forth. The operational perspective, which is what I was most focused on when I was working as an engineer, is does it get the job done? Does it work? Engineers are very, very practical people. But there's another perspective, the inspirational perspective. The modernist aesthetics that go into what technology should look like. And I'll add just as a brief aside, the magnificent wall that we've been promised. That is a pure monument. It will do very little to stop illegal immigration, most of which is just overstaying visa, but it's a magnificent, in-your-face statement to our southern neighbors. Okay. This paper, and I have copies to hand out, this paper is kind of a condensation of an article I'm working on the poetics of technology, and I'm drawing on Kenneth Burke, the great theorist who distinguishes between semantic and poetic meaning. Semantic meaning establishes clear categories. Poetic meaning establishes moods and motivations. Okay. The poetics of technology today emphasize innovation, disruption. One thing I noticed when I was working as an engineer is that the phrase high-tech is not an engineering concept. High-tech is a inspirational, a promotional concept. Engineers don't talk about high-tech unless they're trying to sell something. Okay. Now, parallel with this is the evolution of the corporate form. Okay, we had a wonderful session before this about anthropology of the corporation, and we need to problematize the corporation just a little bit because really it's been in the last century the managerial revolution when corporations went from proprietorships to joint stock corporations and really kind of the modern corporation. This is what Alfred Chandler talked about in Burnham as well. Coincident with the managerial revolution was the rise of interest in technology. You find almost no rhetoric about technology in the 19th century, and it accelerates some in the 1920s. But then from the 60s onwards, interest in technology just booms. Okay. Modernist business, I'm drawing on Marshall Berman's book, All That Is Solid Melts Into Terror, where he critiques modernism and modernity. Okay. Looks at it in terms of changing forms of authority, and coincident with this, incidentally, is the rise of branding. Okay, corporations are about brand. Brand equity is the biggest repository of value. I mean, the book value of a corporation and its brand equity are quite
contrasted. Okay, point being, business takes different forms in different eras, and technology is part of the corporate identity. Okay. Now, if we define poetry as perfection of form and condensation of meaning, okay, then technology is primarily poetic, and this is drawing on not just rhetoric, but also actual network theory. These technological objects condense a lot of meaning into a small, sleek package. I mean, the brilliance of the iPhone is not just in what it does, but how it looks. Okay. So, why is this important practice? Well, just two very quick points. Projects I've worked on in technology, whether developing software systems for the Air Force or analyzing Lamagne Air high-speed rail, understanding, first of all, that there were multiple layers of meaning to the technology was important. Understanding, second, that the client often wasn't completely clear on what he or she wanted. Okay. And with a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald, the test of a first-rate mind, first-rate intelligence, is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. And I think that this is one skill that anthropology gives us. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your talk. I'm Leslie Walker. I just finished my PhD in science and technology studies at Cornell, so that is your A&T reference there. I wondered if you, I also run a small research consulting firm that I own. So I wondered if you could say a little bit more. You started the talk by mentioning that a critique of technology can add value to it. I wondered if you could talk about a little bit more about the sense of value in which you mean that.
Well, okay. Actually, sometimes we talk about value, and basic definition of value is meaningful difference. Okay. And the values that people see in technology are many-layered and often contradictory. Okay. So, and the ethical challenge we have. First of all, somebody's paying me to do a project, so I have to be responsive. But I also have to understand, first of all, that they value on several levels, and second, that they might not always be articulate about what's most important to them. So I really have to read the client, okay, and it's a strategic question. How do I communicate this? I mean, I can't tell client you don't know what you're talking about, but I can kind of listen, that's a skill that anthropology, and kind of maybe then add some insight. I'd hopefully come up with some synthesis between what their articulated desires are and what I see as some hidden meanings that they are not quite yet in touch with. Okay, so, I mean, the value would be kind of what's it like almost any branded object, that there's layers. Okay, and the brilliance of marketing is to be in touch with all of them and condense them into a package. Julia.
I love the idea of technology being related to identity, and I can see that in that Ford Motor Company. Because the technology was all about automobiles, then it was about transportation and different modes of transportation and mobility, and now you see the company embracing a different technology, which is computing, and they're beginning to identify themselves as a computing company. You can see that in the way they are changing the company, because they have a global data insight and analytics organization that has gone from maybe 100 people to close to 1,000 in 2 years.
Wow.
Is centralized and has lots of corporate support from the top. So
beautiful example. Thank you.
I think at this point, we still have 10 minutes, right? So we would like to open up questions for any of the speakers here. Any other questions you have for any of the speakers here?
So thank you for the wonderful presentation. I have a question for maybe all of the panelists. So we try so hard to sell intelligence to business, right? And we want to make technology relevant for their practice, and we want to explain what we do well, and we want them to understand. So I worked with a consulting firm where I got to collaborate with data scientists, and I found it incredibly important for me to understand what they're doing, like their story, and not. Sometimes I try to kind of impose my own story as an anthropologist, you know, on them without really understanding their language. So I started learning, okay, what do they exactly do? What language do they speak? But then I'm kind of stuck because there's only this much that I can learn because I'm not one of them, right? Like, that's not my expertise. So I've always found it difficult to balance between, like, really knowing the natives, like, really speaking their language, and my own identity as an anthropologist, and my inability to just, I just can't learn that much. So I don't know whether any of you has struggled with that, and whether you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, so that's interesting, and I feel like if we could resolve that problem of the gaze of the observer, we could all close them shop and academic and apply. But I think so. I think that adds a little bit of color to the question that I was asked earlier, that so how do we sell our work? And I find that one needs to think of oneself as a translator. So understand, and I find that if you understand enough of the other person's language, that you can use a few key words, talk about, use their words for their customers, their clients, their beneficiaries, it's just one example, then you've built a lot of credibility and trust because you've shown them that you've at least listened. And just like I find this when you travel in foreign countries and try to speak a foreign language, oftentimes people will give you the benefit of the doubt because you've shown that, hey, I'm trying. I'm more interested. Exactly. So I think, yeah, translation matters, and just doing a little bit of that work goes a long way, even if it's not perfect.
So I think it's teaching at business school and having taught in design school, I mean, the translation issue is critical, but I am not going to be a designer and I am not going to be a quantitative finance person, right? So there's an exchange that has to happen, and I don't push with an anthropologist. There are times when I identify as an anthropologist, but honestly, they don't even think about me as that. They hired me to introduce design thinking in the business school because that's what they needed, because that's what businesses want. And I just accept that. That's my end, and anthropology comes out anyway.
So. Good question over here.
Yes, so my question is especially for Derek, all of our other panelists. So I wonder, when one's selling oneself as the anthropologist to a company, on the basis that, you start to get a culture of your organization, what would you say if they asked you, in turn, why should we hire you versus the organizational behavior of PhD?
My short answer to that is because that's an important approach and an important method, but we can also show you something that they can't show you for our deep hanging out method. And we can show you something about your organization you probably don't even know about. That's my very short answer.
If I can jump in from a marketing perspective, I would say that it's my company, my business partner, who is retired, is a PhD psychologist. My company is predominantly made of psychology. But there are some projects that I would work on with my partner, and I would bring an anthropological perspective, and she brings a psychological one. And sometimes the reports would be a mix of the two. But you could always see the anthropology, and you could always see the psychology. And if I'm selling one versus the other, for example, anthropology, I talk about the different kinds of questions we ask. And sometimes, like your case studies, that provide the answers that you really have success or certain kinds of outcomes. They make it very clear that the kind of what we produce is very different than, say, a psychologist would produce, maybe a sociologist, or maybe just someone who works in marketing research but doesn't bring social science perspective to it. So it's really the contrast of the, I think, the questions asked and the outcomes.
Barbara.
This was such a wonderful session because you bring together so many perspectives, and what I got out of it, as Tim and I both teach branding, there's an important marketing element that's the undercurrent in so many of these presentations. from even storytelling, consumer research, the Journal of Consumer Research. There's tons of articles on building narratives, on the contribution of storytelling. And it percolates through so much of the practice of marketing, from packaging to positioning to building brand equity. And I think that's what really the whole anthropological association is needing right now. And Elizabeth's diagnosis of how it is being practiced, I think is very indicative of where we need to go.
It's interesting because, as you said, we both teach branding, and a big change in marketing today is content marketing, which really is not about selling your brand, it's about adding a story, a storyline, and then your brand is embedded in there. So the brand is secondary. You look at the newest ad for Apple, the phone, that where the woman dancing on the street, she puts in the earbuds, she becomes a dancer, she becomes a song, a song she's dancing along. We can pull it up. We've gotten over 2 million hits. So it's a great narrative, and then she shares the earbud that are wireless with the guy she bumps into, and she bumps into him on the street, and there's like this romance and a partnering and how the other goes on. They're dancing together, but the music and the storyline is kind of quick romance is the theme, and the brand is embedded in there. So you get a new direction in branding is to have narratives, to have stories, and the brand is secondary. And that certainly is something that Elizabeth, we need to address in our own discipline.
And just to comment on the why not organizational behavior, I think one of the biggest assets in anthropology is the focus on the group and the group interactions. And it, because organizational behavior and psychology is really oriented to what does this individual do, but as most business people know, the individual in an organizational context only has limited control because, you know, it's the group and the systems and the larger context which influence a lot. And so you having that kind of perspective is very valuable.
Just to follow on with that anthropology versus organizational development, many esteemed colleagues who are in organizational development, so no disrespect intended, but I don't think they do such a great job with the evolution of technology as it impacts organizations. And I think that our training as anthropologists, where we look at artifacts, where we look at language, where we look at evolutionary processes, gives us a better perspective on how organizations change.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering briefly, in terms of, as a consultant coming in, the bad news, you're hired to do a study, and you go out, and you're doing a community, and you find out that actually there's a huge perception in that area that they are bad, that they abandoned the community after moving a factory, or that there is a real environmental or social problem that hasn't been addressed. I've dealt with that a little bit with a lobbying client, but I have to come back and say, actually, we have opposition, and there's these groups, and they don't like us. How do you navigate that, especially kind of that precarious client role?
We, in our, Bob and Tim edited this book on ethics and business anthropology. Okay, and one answer I had is you do some due diligence. Okay, in other words, I mean, when you're young, you take whatever client comes along, but after a while, is this somebody I really want to be working for? Okay, and are they forgive the dismissive language? Are they educable? Okay, and I would say overwhelmingly, business clients, they want to do a better job and so forth. But you have to have this dialogue before you sign the contract. Okay. Otherwise, okay, then because once you sign the contract, you're kind of in a straitjacket almost. So there's a lot of opportunity to educate the client up front.
So, I'm going to respond to that as a project manager and someone who teaches project management. And one of the central precepts of project management is the project draws change. Right? And change has winners and losers. So part of your educational process is to understand and analyze the stakeholders and figure out who's along that spectrum, who your supporters are going to be and who your opponents are going to be. And so if you're coming in and saying, surprise, we have opposition, then the people who are hiring you are not very experienced in many departments, and certainly some sorts of opposition are more unethical and more problematic than others. But I don't think one should ever be surprised that any kind of project has a problem.
I would just say that I think oftentimes reframing is really powerful, and so if somebody's some of the problems, I think if you sort of like switch to a little judo move and sort of switch that into an opportunity, that can be a whole new kind of way to talk about it and think about the movement rather than just sort of solving the problem.
One more, Marianne.
Yeah, one thing I loved about this panel is how you brought together what we have sometimes called distinctive parts of business anthropologists, whether the design anthropologists, the organizational anthropologists, and new branders. We wish it could be. But you really showed how to help a company implement new design, new branding position requires an understanding of the company and its politics and culture. And it's a very nice, holistic
perspective. Well, thank you. We have a website, so do come to our website, our businessanthro.com. So we have a new website, and to look on the website for all kinds of recent collection of articles.